What could you learn from a musical duo that has more than 250,000 subscribers on YouTube and sells more than 100,000 downloads a year? You're about to find out. This is part one of my interview with Jack and Natalie from the YouTube sensation Pomplamoose on this episode of Artist Empowerment Radio. Hey, it's Bob Baker here saying thanks so much for listening to the podcast. Before I get to that interview, just want to remind you that if you want to get ongoing tips on music marketing and music career development and so on, please subscribe to my e-zine. It's called The Buzz Factor, same as the website, which is thebuzzfactor.com. Just go there and sign up for the free email updates. It's really the longest running music marketing and music tips email newsletter on the planet. I started delivering information by email in about 1995. Yep, it's a long time ago. Anyway, you're in for a real treat. This is part one of my interview with Pomplamoose. I actually did this interview two or three months ago, and I've made the whole thing available to members of my music marketing mentorship program. But this was so good that I wanted to share the whole thing with the public and anyone who wanted to listen. So I'm making the whole thing available in two parts, and during the recording, I reference 250,000 subscribers, which I did at the beginning of the show. I just looked, though, and they're actually over 300,000 subscribers now, and tens of millions of views. And so anyway, you're going to learn a lot about their indie success story. It's very inspiring, so let's get right to it. Here's my interview with Pomplamoose.
All right, I am really thrilled to be talking to two people that are on the line with me right now. I'm talking about Jack Conti and Natalie Dawn of the musical duo known as Pomplamoose. And Jack and Natalie, hello. Thanks for being here today.
Hey there.
Thank you.
This is a real thrill for me because I've been following your exploits and your successes on YouTube and elsewhere for at least the last couple of years or so. And, yeah, it's been a real thrill to talk to you, and I know a lot of the indie musicians who listen to the podcast and are members of the Music Marketing Mentorship Program are going to be eager to hear what you have to say about your story here. So, and I'm really thrilled, too, because I was actually doing a little last-minute research to sort of enhance what I already knew about you, and I found out that you were just, like, in mid-April, you were on NPR's All Things Considered. So you've even most recently got some good media exposure there, and I'm sure other places too.
Yeah, I actually think that was April of last year.
Yeah,
really?
It was a while ago. Yeah.
Oh, I just saw April, and I assumed it was last month. So I'm a year behind. You know, congratulations on that, nonetheless. So
thank you.
I'm sure you've gotten a lot more media exposure since then, because I know you've been pretty active this past year. But I know that, I mean, a lot of people know you because of your very creative YouTube videos, and am I not mistaken, are you past 250,000 subscribers at this point?
We are, yeah. We have about somewhere between 260 and 270,000 subscriptions on
YouTube. We don't like to say 250,000, because then, you know, we get a little too confident and
Oh, really?
So then you're comparing yourself to a million.
Yeah.
So 260,000 sounds, yeah, rolls off the tongue, feels a little
bit more indie.
It's more modern. More than 250,000. I get that. I can appreciate that. And do you know, I don't have the page in front of me, but do you know like how many views that equates to with all of your different, like how many videos are posted and how many total views you've had of the various ones?
Yeah, it's about 55 million upload views.
Wow, that's awesome. And I know obviously some videos get a lot more than others, as is often the case. And what was the date? Like, when did you first post your first video as Pomplamoose on
it
YouTube?
June of 2008.
So summer 2008. So we're already coming up on like three years here. So that's cool. So I definitely want to talk to you. I definitely want to have a chance to dissect a little bit of those early days and how you built up the audience that you have. But I think a lot of people, even those who maybe have been following you, might be interested just to know a little bit about your background. Like, what did you do musically up until that point, either together or separately, if you could give me just a little bit about your musical background.
Nat, you want to start?
Sure. Well, I honestly didn't have much musical formation before sort of getting into a group with Jack. When I was younger, I had, you know, the typical piano lessons and things like that. But so I guess it was somewhere in my subconscious.
You did a lot of singing in church.
I did a lot of singing in church. Yeah, I was my dad was a pastor, and so I grew up with my mom leading music and stuff like that. But my like bass playing, that was all self-taught, as was my guitar playing. And Jack and I met actually when I was performing at the coffee house on our campus, and I was opening for the band that he was in. So yeah, I didn't have much formation, but I was still writing music and singing before we met.
And Natalie, what year was that when that occurred, when you two met like that?
That was 2006, yeah.
Okay, so it's a couple of years before you started the U2. So still relatively recently, 5 years ago?
Yeah, we waited a while to start the band after dating, you know, because it hasn't proven to be a very good thing for for people's relationships to start bands together.
Oh, right. Yeah,
they don't always turn out great, but so far so good, fortunately for us.
Well, good.
How about you, Jack? Your formation.
My formation. So I started with piano lessons when I was about 6, and mostly classical. My dad taught me some blues kind of stuff, and I was playing blues with him as I was growing up. So I learned improvisation and jazz, and then I switched to jazz piano lessons when I was about 12. Took those through high school, played in various big bands and jazz combos for 4 or 5 years. And then when I got to college, I decided to major in music, and so I studied music with a focus in composition, and then also music science and technology, which is, I like to call making computers fart and calling it music. but it's also known as algorithmic composition and noise generation and things like that. So, my background is sort of the opposite of Natalie's. I pretty much started music when I was 6, and I haven't stopped yet.
Thank God that you have it. Yeah, I'll probably come back to ask you about that technical background. I have a feeling that has come in really handy with all the things that you've done, especially being a sort of self-reliant artist, which we're going to get into here pretty quick. But I know there was something I discovered, and right before I started the recording, it was revealed to us that you had a certain book that you read several years ago, which I loved hearing about. It was called The Guerrilla Music Marketing Handbook. Did you not read that several years ago?
I absolutely did read that. And when I graduated college and I had that holy shit moment, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? As a poor starving musician, I started trying to figure out how I was going to get to the bottom of that problem. And I read that book and was very inspired by it. Natalie was just saying,
you were always reading things and telling me about them. And it was like, I didn't even have to read it because you just recited the whole thing to me.
Yeah.
You couldn't shut up about it.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
Awesome. That's wonderful to hear. The first version of that book actually came out way back, I mean, like 1996, you know, in a very early crude version. It's been updated many times, you know, repackaged over the years. But, yeah, I think it's probably launched a lot more careers than I'm even aware of, you know. And so I love hearing this, especially from people that have attained a certain level of prominence. So thank you. Thanks so much for sharing that. But I'll take the focus off of me and put it back on you. So you met, I guess, started collaborating in 2008, or maybe you waited to collaborate musically, I think you said, or you met in 2006, I'm sorry. In 2008, you posted the first video. And those early videos, were they not focused on mainly cover songs? Is that sort of what started your rise to prominence on YouTube?
Well, actually, the first ones were originals, right? Paul's Encore and Hail Mary.
Yeah, we did mainly originals to start off with. It wasn't until August of 2009 that
really?
we we had this revelation when we went to New York to produce another well-known YouTube artist. She was far more well-known than we were, actually, and she wanted Jack to produce her next album, Julia Nunes, and we sort of got the chance to observe her model while we were there and came to the realization that covers were really important when it came to getting your name out there. Because people don't know to search for your original songs for the most part. They will search for covers, or they'll search for a song that they want to hear on YouTube, and then they'll come across your stuff, and if you're lucky, they'll like it, and they'll go look at your original material or other songs and maybe go buy your songs on iTunes.
Yeah, in the end, I think it's a matter of SEO, which, you know, is search engine optimization. And if you have a multi-million dollar, it's true, it's the case. If you have a multi-million dollar marketing machine behind you that's buying billboard space and television time and promoting your concerts through, you know, PR agencies that have connections with blogs, and I mean, then you don't have to work on SEO because the word is out there. Wherever people get their news, they see your name. If you don't have access to that machinery, you need to figure out how to get the word out there. And I think for an indie musician, SEO, particularly on YouTube, is probably the most effective means of doing that. And that means simply latching on to cultural phenomena, whether they are music-related or business-related or news-related, anything that is current, and get lots of searches on either Google or YouTube, particularly YouTube for us, since that was our medium of choice. And if you simply upload content with similar tags, then a lot of modern sites that use recommendations as a basis for their for keeping people on their site are going to recommend your content after someone watches content that's tagged similarly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we upload Single Ladies, someone who goes to YouTube to watch Single Ladies is going to get recommended the Pomplamoose version of Single Ladies right after they finish. And they're going to see a big, pretty picture of Natalie's face with the, you know, Single Ladies cover written under it. And they're going to feel compelled to click on it. So that was sort of this revelation that we had a couple of years ago. And I think that was probably the, you know, the most important part of our success that we've had so far.
I think the Single Ladies still frame is actually a little androgynous. I wouldn't say it's pretty.
It's a Justin Bieber sort of pretty.
It is, and unfortunately, yeah, they only give you a certain number of the still images that you can choose from, and usually it's the best flattering of the three or whatever that they give you. But I'm glad you brought that up, because I think, I mean, again, I know you discovered this and started doing this in 2009, and I think over the years, I think more and more musicians are aware of the power of cover songs, but I think it's still a lot of people write it off. And when it comes to the SEO thing in particular, like I've kind of laughed when some musicians have come up to me over the years and go, "Hey, I'm doing really well on Google. I searched for my name and it came up number one." I'm going, "Well, that's great, but how many people are searching for your name?" You know, especially when you're earlier in your career. I mean, that's great, but you actually want to come up when people are searching for other things. You know, and how they discover you. And so cover songs, and topical songs, things are relevant in the news. I mean, there's a lot of people have done really well by writing clever and well-written songs about those things. So you started the covers in August of 2009, and I've read, too, that one of the big things that boosted you, and maybe you could – I'm not sure where this falls in the timeline, but didn't YouTube feature you, like, on the homepage at a certain point, which really sort of – did that maybe cause a tipping point, maybe?
Yes, when we released Single Ladies, that got featured on the homepage.
And before that, actually, Hail Mary, when we were just starting off, that helped us get a couple thousand subscribers. But Single Ladies really was our lucky streak. I mean,
that was a break for us.
That was a break. And our fan base quintupled within, like,
A couple weeks,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And was that also in what year? Was that 2009 or is that I can't remember when that single or that.
Yeah, that was 2009.
Okay. That was 2009. Yeah.
So you had a pretty early success once you started going the cover route, it sounds like.
Immediate.
Yeah.
It was immediate. Yeah.
And so what's the, I guess, well, maybe I could find out, like, what your, since then, what your philosophy is for choosing cover songs, and maybe how should it, how can it apply to an indie band or an indie artist that's, you know, still trying to gain a following and all that. What's your philosophy about choosing, and then how do you, because there's different ways of doing it. You could try to do a true rendition, but it seems like a lot of people do really well by doing something that's quite different from the original, but yet still has the elements there. Like, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I approach, there. I guess because of my jazz background, I approach covers sort of with a jazz philosophy, which is take a melody and strip away everything else and then make something that sounds like you, as if you had written that melody. That's really fun, and it's challenging because you ditch the chords, you ditch the production, you ditch the sounds, you completely reharmonize everything, and that was more interesting to us because then we felt like we could bring our own voices into the cover. And also, you know, we don't really want to be a cover band. I mean, we view covers as a means to an end. It's sort of the marketing side, if you will. And a lot of that, there's a blurry line there because sometimes the covers turn into products themselves. Like, you know, that was a lot of our album sales last year was covers. But obviously, we'd like to be selling more originals than covers, and so so we're trying to move away from covers now, which is why we haven't uploaded a cover in quite a while, except for
Angry Bird, which we did yesterday.
Right. Well, that was the first one in a year.
You actually got a write up on Mashable on your Angry Birds.
Yeah.
And I have I know of Angry Birds. I know it's like one of the most popular apps. I have just refused to download it because it just sounds like a big time suck waster or something. So I'm not familiar with the theme, but I know I'm sure millions of people are. So it's probably a very smart move. But was that your way of doing a cover without doing a traditional cover, I guess? Or?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty different than it actually sounds. I think.
For one, there are vocals in it.
Yeah.
but
there's no vocals in the original song.
But yeah, it was different.
Yeah, it's pretty different.
It was different. But.
Yeah.
Cool. So I like that. I mean, I think it's smart, and I think maybe that's why a lot of bands or artists go, I'm not going to do cover songs on YouTube. I want to plot, you know, focus on my own stuff. But I think probably depending on where you are and sort of the evolutionary scale or path of a career, probably early on, it's smart to do more covers. But yeah, the idea is to attract people and get them to learn about your originals. Another thing that I'm wondering, yeah, if you've done, did you, like, when you gain, like, so you get, attract people with the covers, did you have some mechanisms in place, like, to, once they were watching a cover, to get them to not only subscribe to your YouTube channel, but did you have things in place to get them on a mailing list, to get another way to interact with fans?
No, we were totally disorganized. I had no idea what was going on. I think we probably, over the last 3 years, we could have accumulated a really
one
nice
hell of a mailing
list. Oh boy, did we mess up there. We don't really have a mailing list, and that's a huge, we've done ourselves a huge disservice. Had we had that in place, that would have been big, but right now we're working on a website. We don't even really have a comprehensive website, so we're working on that to sort of get that up and running and make sure that, you know, that we have that kind of stuff in place for the future. But in terms of musicians who say that they don't want to do covers on YouTube, I think that's totally fine. That's great. But they don't, and I'm not sure if I read this in your book, Bob, or I heard it from somewhere, but they don't call it the music. They call it the music business. And you've got, if you're not going to upload covers, you got to do something so that to help people find you. And if it's not going to be covers, it's got to be something that people are searching for, or some way that's going to get people to your stuff, because no one's going to search for someone's original songs that they haven't heard of. It's just not done.
Right.
So if you're not going to do covers, you got to still have some kind of marketing strategy in mind, I think, if you want your music to be heard.
Absolutely. And I applaud you for admitting your lapse in whatever in judgment or planning about the mailing list, because I think that's great. Well, there's a couple of lessons there. One is you can still be successful and still not have every duck in a row. You know, as long as you've got enough elements firing, you can still do pretty well. And I'm going to ask you a little bit here pretty quick about how you're actually making a decent living doing music, which is a goal of a lot of people. But still, maybe have not all the pieces of the puzzle. But I guess would it be safe to say that you would recommend for any artist, especially early on, that the mailing list? It sounds like you do know it's an important component. When you would encourage artists of all kinds to start building one now or sooner rather than later.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially because. I don't remember the statistic exactly, but I think 99% or higher, maybe it's 99.9, it's unusually high, you wouldn't expect this, of YouTube views come from non-account holders. In other words, if Single Ladies has 100 views, 99 of those views are from people who don't even know that you can create an account on YouTube and subscribe to videos.
Right.
So even if they see your video and like it, they have no way of staying in touch with you unless you have, an email or a text message or an RSS feed or a blog or something that they can subscribe to. So, yeah, it's essential to have some method of keeping in touch with people who like your stuff.
Right. And even simply putting at the beginning or the end of every video clip an offer to, hey, if you like that song or or some little tease that they can get a free download of either that song or another group of songs if they go to the website, and some kind of call to action to try to engage with people is probably the best way to leverage the attention that you get. But obviously you still have done well, but just think how much better
I know it's a shame,
but that's okay. It's never too late.
So that ends part one of my interview with Jack and Natalie from Pomplamoose. Hope you enjoyed that. Yes, I have to admit, I was quite thrilled to find out that Jack was a big fan of the Guerrilla Music Marketing Handbook a few years ago. That was very cool to hear. Now, I wouldn't be a very good self-promoter if I didn't happen to mention that you can still purchase that book. Yes, indeed, the latest incarnation of it at thebuzzfactor.com. If you buy it from my site, I'll even send you an autographed copy. You can also get it from Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, but those won't come autographed, of course. When you buy it from my site, I also give you some bonus stuff, some extra reports and so on. So there's some perks of getting it directly from me. But however you consume that book or any of my other resources, it's fine by me as long as you get the stuff and you consume it. And then most importantly, put the ideas into action, the ones that most apply to your situation. So that's it for this episode. I'll be back with episode 63 and part two of the Pomplamoose interview. In the meantime, continued success. So go out there and spread your music to the people that need to hear it the most, and have fun doing it. This is Bob Baker saying so long for now, and thanks for listening to Artist Empowerment Radio.